It's interesting, isn't it, to hear that mixed reaction to the Julian Assange situation, both here and overseas. People are in two minds about the entire thing. Julian Assange, one paper said today, has been prohibited from entering the United States without permission, as his newfound freedom drew mixed reaction from conservative and liberal politicians. That's happening pretty much in Australia too. In the US, former US president, vice president rather, Mike Pence, a moderate Republican, criticised the Biden administration's plea deal with the Australian, labelling it a miscarriage of justice. He said Julian Assange endangered the lives of our troops in a time of war and should have been prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. The Biden administration's plea deal with Assange is a miscarriage of justice and dishonours the service and sacrifice of the men and women of our armed forces, he said, and he should have been punished. There should be no plea deals to avoid prison for anyone that endangers the security of our military or the national security of the United States ever. There were different opinions. Cornel West is an independent US presidential candidate, far from the left. My dear brother Julian Assange is free, he sent out on social media. Hard right politician Marjorie Taylor Greene, just a little bit crazy, said the video of Assange boarding a flight out of the UK, an incredible sight. Julian Assange walking free outdoors. Another independent presidential candidate and anti-establishment figure, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., said, I am overjoyed. He is a generational hero. So, on that note, let's welcome TJ O'Hara, a good friend and himself a one-time independent presidential candidate back in 2012. Good to catch up, TJ.
Good speaking with you, Ray.
It's interesting, isn't it, the diverse reactions to Assange, both here and in your country. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, he had been indicted by the Department of Justice back in 2019, and it was 17 counts of espionage and one count of computer misuse with up to 175 years in prison or even the death penalty. So this is a serious case. Now, in April, the U.S. government waived the death penalty part of it and provided him assurance that he could seek a First Amendment protection, which makes this even more interesting. And today, even though he had potentially 175 years on the line, he pled guilty to one count of conspiring to unlawfully obtain and disseminate classified information relating to national defense. And he escaped with a release based on time served, which was 62 months.
Yeah.
Albeit he was in exile longer than that. So the only other part of the plea deal is he has to destroy the 90,000 pages of documents related to Afghanistan and the over 400,000, I believe it was, related to the war in Iraq. So it's interesting that the punishment didn't fit the premise of the crime, but we have a lot of that going on in this country at this point.
You do.
When you think about it, you know, the scope of the crime constituted the biggest security breach of its kind in U.S. military history. So he had to be charged. I think that's where Mike Pence is coming from. The information was received illegally. It pertained to national defense. Its unauthorized public release put various U.S. programs and operatives at risk. And it's the type of crime for which one might expect to be hung, at least in a movie.
Let me ask you, TJ, let me ask you this, because, again, we're a long way away and we, you know, we read about these things, but we don't live in your country. To me, much of this spins around whether he is, in fact, a publisher. Because if he is a publisher, as he claims to be, now there are plenty of publishers and journalists who say he's not, but let's presume for a moment he is a publisher. He published all this stuff that Chelsea Manning stole and gave to him so he could dump it. How is that different to what the New York Times does and the Washington Post does and all the other major newspapers do whenever somebody illegally takes something and dumps it on their desk?
I think it was the nature of the crime that's probably a reasonable differentiator. You know, was this done in the name of journalism or the way in the name of promoting WikiLeaks?
Yeah.
The information released, was it being released to expose, you know, embarrassing government secrets, as sometimes you see through the New York Times and other publishers like that? Or was it done for more the marketing of it, to make a name for himself, make a name for WikiLeaks? You know, I think the pursuit of Assange represented an assault on the concept of freedom of the press to some people. And that's that's the interesting part. It reminds me a little bit about your book, where you have that balance of pivotal issues.
Yes.
So you've got clearly a crime on one end, but you've got these countervailing imbalances, if you will. And correspondingly, you have to wonder, I'll give you a third premise. You have to wonder how this case impacts the concept of whistleblower protection.
Yes.
If he was trying to get out potentially embarrassing government secrets, why isn't it similar to whistleblower? Now, I think Eric Snowden is a better example of that. But that argument could be made, too, had this ever actually gone to court and not been pled out.
That's really interesting. We've got a little time here. If you'd like to talk to TJ, you're more than welcome to give us a buzz, 1-833-882. Before we get on to the debate tomorrow, I just wanted to ask you one question, again, related to something happening here. Nuclear energy. Our opposition at the Conservative Party are talking about adding it to our energy mix, but the Labor government wasting no time to mount, the usual scare campaign. Now, as I understand it, TJ, correct me if I'm wrong, the US has about 96 reactors providing something like 20% of your energy needs. Is it a talking point over there at all?
You know, our conservative and liberal leadership is in alignment with yours, although we pride ourselves on maintaining a higher degree of hypocrisy when we argue issues.
Well done.
Our liberal leaders are entirely committed to addressing climate change, but only if we do it by funneling money to programs that sound good but will have little effect.
Yeah.
The technology surrounding nuclear energy has evolved dramatically, I think, since the days of Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, yet the liberals are unwilling to follow that particular science. So given their willingness to force electric vehicles on the public, their resistance to nuclear energy is somewhat quizzical because they've already ruled out coal, natural gas, even hydropower to generate electricity that's going to be necessary to fulfill that mandate. So it would appear that their hope rests on climate change generating some sort of searing sun to charge their favorite solar panels and extreme winds to spin their turbines. Meanwhile, the conservatives are trying to raise nuclear energy as an alternative, but only because the solar and wind lobbies don't contribute to their campaign. That's my opinion.
And so it goes. We'll come back and talk about tomorrow's big debate next. TJ O'Hara is our guest from the United States. I'm Greg Carey, sitting in for Sophie. It's 2:15 on 4BC. TJ O'Hara joining us from the United States in the West Coast, where he lives and once ran for the presidency back in 2012 as an independent candidate. TJ, thanks for doing this. Remind us again why you ran as an independent. You were trying to say something about the system, weren't you?
Yes, I wasn't running to be competitive because that takes over $1 billion. Unfortunately, it's all driven by money. I was trying to create a more informed electorate to show them what a candidate who actually has studied the issues and had plausible solutions could offer. So in the off chance someday money wouldn't be as important, they could look for somebody of substance who could bring solutions that would benefit everybody rather than just the party.
Okay, let me get into the issues of the debate tomorrow in just a moment. Ahead of that, we had a text from Gabrielle, who says, do you really think CNN, who's hosting the debate, who hate Trump with a passion, are going to give him a fair go? And that prompts a call from Dave from Cannon Hill. Go right ahead, Dave.
Yeah, Greg, how are you, mate? Pleasure to speak to the TJ. As the previous person just said, I understand it's being sort of put on by CNN, who used to be, whether they said, I don't know, a bit pro-Democrat. Now, who exactly is going to be the muting of the... Who's going to be doing the muting of the microphones?
Yeah, because sorry, mate. No, I'll leave it there because I think the point's made. We don't have a lot of time because some people, TJ, won't know that they're actually going to mute the mics of the person not talking to stop the interruptions we saw last year. What are you making of that? And who does the muting?
You know, I don't know who specifically will do it. I don't know if it will be the host or someone else once time runs out. But the DNC got to call the shots. And as a result, CNN's going to be controlling the flow of the debate, and there's not going to be an audience to provide any type of feedback. Interestingly enough, and you take this one with a grain of salt, they're going to have 29 fact checkers.
Incredible.
That you've got two presidential candidates whom they must apparently distrust so much that they have to have 29 fact checkers. And I find that ludicrous.
I mean, who the hell do these people think they are? Why not just let the two of them debate, talk, chat, whatever you want to do, and let viewers make up their own mind and do their own fact checking? It makes more sense, doesn't it?
Well, sure. To Gabriel's and Dave's point, there's a bias inherent with CNN at this point in time. I think that's fairly well established, just as there's one with Fox and MSNBC. But the other thing to keep in mind, this is going to be the earliest presidential debate in history. And that's important for several reasons. First of all, we're talking about these two candidates debating. There was a third candidate. And the time frame made it extremely difficult for Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to qualify at 15% or more in four polls. So it gave CNN an excuse not to invite him. Although I will say Trump was open to his participation.
He would have been good, TJ. He would have been good to have in the debate because he would have been a polarizing figure. And he's an intellectual bloke. He's a smart bloke. He's a pleasant bloke. And he's getting about 10 to 12% of the vote.
Yeah, in some cases, in certain demographics, I saw with the youth vote, he was actually polling about 11% ahead of Joe Biden.
Wow.
In second place.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fact that he was carved out of this on some technical issues, and yet the two people who are debating aren't even technically candidates at this point for their parties. They haven't been nominated because the conventions haven't been held. Now, the other thing that's interesting about the early date is that if President Biden falters, either physically or mentally, it gives the DNC time to replace him at the convention, because that doesn't happen until August 19th. So it almost creates a bait-and-switch opportunity if Trump continues to outpoll the president in the swing states.
It's incredible, isn't it, really? Because, again, we look from this distance. You're there. You're seeing it every day. But we're seeing enough of Joe Biden to say, look, he's clearly in decline. He's over 80 now. His chances of even surviving if he wins the presidency again are only 40%, which leaves Kamala Harris as the president of the United States. How is it that the Democrats are running Joe Biden? There's surely got to be a better candidate.
I think he beat Donald Trump once, and they're convinced that he could potentially beat him again. I think what they aren't paying attention to is how he beat him the first time.
Mm.
We were in the midst of a pandemic. People were scrambling. Donald Trump is obviously a clinical narcissist, so he has a profound way of irritating people with his comments and so forth. It's not that his policies were so bad, but he had a way of pushing people away and aggravating people. He's not the prototype. I don't think that any of us, or any, at least any rational people, would say, this is the person I want representing my country. So they settled for Joe Biden, who was going to bring back normalcy. He was going to unite the country, and he was going to have programs that were in favor of the people. Well, he's done none of those three things.
He's divided the country.
If you're in this country and you listen to the rhetoric, yes.
Yeah.
He'll give a speech about uniting the country, but he always has to throw in extreme MAGA Republicans. Well, that's pushing part of the country away.
Yeah. It's interesting because, related to what you're just talking about, the independents will decide your election, I imagine, the same as swing voters, as we call them, or independents in Australia, decide all our elections here, the people who aren't fixed on one side or the other. Who do you think, I mean, that's what makes this debate tomorrow really, really important. So I guess both will be, particularly Trump, will be aiming themselves at those independents, yeah?
Well, no question. At least that's what he should do. If he can curb his personality, both sides want to achieve the same goal. Each side wants to land a knockout blow, something so devastating that it'd be a radical shift in the momentum. And both parties are probably going to be disappointed. The president probably doesn't have the capacity to do that at this point in time. It'll be interesting to see how he's able to navigate 90 minutes of unscripted answers and so forth and responding to questions, assuming he doesn't have them. The former President Trump will have a hard time controlling his own personality and taking negative shots at people and so forth. If they stayed on point, it would be very, very interesting. But you know, at the end of the day, the Democrats and their media acolytes are going to claim victory if President Biden simply remains standing and doesn't babble too much or freeze on screen. And the Republicans are going to claim victory if former President Trump doesn't threaten to create internment camps for political opponents or call Joe too many childish names. Either way, we'll know for sure if you and I have the opportunity to talk about it tomorrow.
Yeah, well, we'll do that. Let's have a chat a little after 1 o'clock tomorrow. It finishes around about midday our time, I think a little earlier. Maybe we can talk tomorrow a little after 1 o'clock. Do you see a change in Donald Trump's public persona in recent times as a result of the court cases, as a result of what you're talking about having to be seen to be more moderate, more stable, more something?
I think he still likes to have fun. He still goes off script when in some cases when he shouldn't. He still fights back. If he feels that he's being personally attacked, he's going to fire back. But he does seem to be a kinder, gentler form of Donald Trump, but not to the degree that you would say, okay, this is the person I would typecast as being a global leader. He still is self-focused. And if he could just learn to temper his personality and focus on the issues, I think he has a winning campaign. If he can't do that, then the Never Trumpers, as they're affectionately called over here in the United States on the conservative side, aren't going to vote for him. They can't bring themselves to vote for him. And then, of course, you know, the Democrats, who may not particularly favor President Biden, see Trump as a greater threat. And of course, they're playing all the things about Trump's, you know, another Hitler. He's an autocrat. He's a totalitarian. He's going to put people in concentration camps, none of which is true. He served for 4 years. He didn't do any of that back then. In fact, if anybody's been politically persecuted, you could probably make an argument it was him.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. In all of this, and again, we'll talk to you after the debate tomorrow, the vice presidential pick for Donald Trump is going to be pivotal, isn't it? Sometimes they say in America that it doesn't really matter who the vice president is because everybody votes the top of the ticket. But this time round, he's going to really need somebody to compliment him, as I guess you could say Mike Pence did first time round.
No question about it. I mean, there's already one vice president cast, so that's Kamala Harris. The Democratic Party can't work that out. They can't push her out regardless of how she's performed. And that actually is a risk for them because some people are going to consider, what if President Biden doesn't make it through the entire term? Mm. On the Republican side, at least you have a list. I think it's been narrowed down from what I'm hearing. It's potentially North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, and Florida Senator Marco Rubio. There are a couple of others whose names have been floated, but these seem to be the people who have already been given vetting documents. And each has a strength, each has a weakness. I think all but one of them is probably capable of doing the job right now, and I'll be open about who I wouldn't favor. I don't think J.D. Vance at 40 years old is that much of a benefit. He can help secure Ohio, which is a swing state and has 17 electoral votes, but he's too young and inexperienced. The other thing that's interesting is he once declared himself a Never Trump guy, and he wondered at one point if Trump might be, to quote him, America's Hitler. So I have a hard time seeing Trump get past that.
Yeah.
He has some affinity for him. Yeah. I think Burgum has been kind of following him around and supporting him. He may be the person with whom Trump best identifies. He's a wealthy businessman. He has gubernatorial experience. He's reliable and low-key. He's never going to, although no one will, no one can take the limelight away from President Trump, but he has that subtle personality and so forth. The problem is he doesn't create any voter excitement, and he's from North Dakota that only has three votes in a hyper-red state. And he's going to be 72 in 2028. So I think the party would be better served looking at Tim Scott or Marco Rubio. Tim's 59, Marco's 53. They both can bring constituencies with them, at least slightly impacting, in Tim Scott's case, the black vote.
Yeah.
Marco Rubio's the Latino vote. And a slight change in that vote might be enough.
Okay.
And
there's much to follow, mate. We nearly need to wrap it up now, but we'll check in tomorrow a little after 1 hour time and see how you've seen the debate, which will be over by then. Really appreciate that. TJOHara.com. You'll get TJ and his books and his thoughts and his analysis and all kinds of things. TJOHara.com and on X, TJOHara2012. Good to talk to you, mate. We'll do it again tomorrow.
Thank you, Greg. Look forward to it.
See ya.